asteroid mining, and space hospitality. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. From metals to rare elements, there are a lot of materials that can come from mining objects in space. But who owns things like asteroids? And what are some ethical considerations when planning to do something like drilling on the moon? We'll speak with planetary scientist Philip Metzger about mining off of our planet. Then, space tourism and hospitality isn't a far-off idea. We'll speak with UCF's Amy Gregory about what space hospitality looks like. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? As we further explore into space, scientists are finding things within asteroids and on the moon that could be pretty valuable back here on Earth. While the idea of space mining for resources for economic or political reasons hasn't happened just yet, the future of such things is not too far off. Could there be mini missions that would drill on an asteroid and send materials back, or would it look like factories on the moon? And what are some ethical considerations when it comes to mining in space? We're here to talk more about space mining is Philip Metzger. He's a planetary scientist and the director of the Stephen Hawking Center for Microgravity Research and Education at the University of Central Florida. Philip, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Hi, glad to be back.
Glad to have you back. We are talking mining planetary bodies when it comes to like asteroids and even the moon. But before we get into, you know, what's currently happening, what is the draw to this? Why are people interested in pursuing plans to do this?
Yeah, well, I guess there's at least two or three different motivations. One is because we envision this great future that's like Star Trek, where we have spacecraft and people living on other planets and we're traveling and it's vibrant and outward facing. We want to make that happen. But to make that happen, we're going to have to start using resources outside the Earth because we can't launch everything from the Earth. The second reason is a growing recognition that especially AI is going to create a gigantic environmental burden on the planet, and that it actually is going to become economically viable to start putting industry, including AI, in space. So there is a desire to create that capability to protect our planet. Then I think that there's a third reason, just the normal geopolitical conflicts between countries wanting to impress allies and to impress your adversaries as well, and also to position ourselves to influence policy in space so that when new things become viable, new business cases in the future, we will have a policy that is supportive of our side. You know, it's not just the business case of today that matters for policy, it's the business case for the next 100 years that matters.
Let's talk about that because, you know, we're talking about what kind of planetary bodies here, like asteroids, right?
Well, yes, asteroids for sure. Also the moon, eventually Mars, but I think work on Mars would be mostly just to support activities on Mars. So I think that's the majority of the interest, the moon and asteroids.
You know, we've been hearing a lot about Artemis, you know, and especially long-term plans for lunar base, that those resources utilizing it, that sounds like a great case for doing this. But when you think of something like asteroids, that seems really, really difficult, right? We've only had a few missions that have actually made it to an asteroid. What are the technical challenges of setting up mining operations on these planetary bodies beyond the moon?
With asteroids, there's at least three completely different concepts of how to do mining on an asteroid. And that's because asteroids have a gigantic variation in size. So there are large asteroids like Ceres, which is a dwarf planet, and there's enough gravity that you could have a rover driving around on it. Then there's medium-sized, like Itokawa or Bennu. They would be more difficult to operate around because the gravity is so low, but there is some gravity, and you could extract material and bring that material back from the body back to the Earth. And then there's the really small ones that are maybe 10 meters in diameter or down to just 3 meters in diameter. And those are small enough that you might bag the entire asteroid and bring the entire asteroid back to the cislunar region of space and mine mine it when it's here. So there's entirely different scenarios, either set a mining camp up on a big one or just extract material from a medium one or bring back the entire small one.
So bringing an asteroid back to cislunar space, I kind of remember NASA floating that idea previously, right? Lassoing the asteroid and bringing it back. Is that really easier than just sending something out there to mine it?
It's a business decision, ultimately.
Right.
You have to develop the technologies either way. And so it's a trade-off of how hard the tech will be to develop, how long the mission will be, you know, what is the capital cost and the time involved to get material back to the Earth. And thirdly, there's also the issue about how many asteroids of the appropriate size are available. So it's a very complicated business decision, but we've continued to see companies developing the ability to bag an asteroid and bring it back. TransAstra, a friend of mine, Joel Surcell, the founder and CEO of that company, has recently tested on board the space station the ability to bag an asteroid. And he's announced plans that he wants to bag multiple small asteroids and put them into an orbit on the rim of our solar system to become a new mini moon. And you could actually congregate multiple small asteroids together to build a larger amount of mass at that point in space. So there has been continued work in this.
Would that be all of the same composition, or are we thinking about this kind of like asteroid smorgasbord of all these different materials that will be in one place for these businesses to mine?
I don't know for sure, but I imagine they might want to get a smorgasbord of different types of asteroids, because the carbonaceous asteroids have a lot of water and they have some carbon. The metallic type asteroids, of course, have a lot of iron and nickel. Then you've got the silicate asteroids. So if you want rocky material, but they also contain inclusions of metal, and some of them include precious metals. By getting a variety of different asteroid types, you could fill out your supply chain.
Philip, I love the idea of kind of a cislunar buffet of these materials now that I'm thinking about it. But as you mentioned, there's plans to go to these asteroids to mine them, to use the resources that are on them to build facilities and logistics. But let's talk about the ethics of this. Who do these asteroids belong to? If anyone?
That's a tough question, and I don't think there's an easy answer. I think ultimately it would be good for not just humanity, but for all life if we can use resources beyond planet Earth. It's useful for humanity because we can become a multiplanetary species with a more vibrant civilization and ensure our safety in the cosmos better than now. There are a lot of benefits for humanity, but it also benefits all the species of Earth because we can offload a lot of our environmental burden in the future. And also, you know, eventually Earth's going to get wiped out one way or another. It might be a billion years from now, but there's always a risk. And out of all the species on Earth, the humans are the only ones so far capable of building spaceships. So there might be an ethical responsibility for us to ensure the safety of all the life on planet Earth and take it all with us to space. There's a lot of aspects to the question. One of the big questions is, how do humans divvy it up? Do we just have a few billionaires own the companies that go out and build a million times Earth's productivity in space and they own it entirely? Or do we somehow democratize it? Do we have some system where people in multiple countries participate, not just the wealthy countries? A lot of difficult challenges there. Unfortunately, I don't think there's going to be a lot of clarity on all the issues. I think there's going to be a lot of real politic that happens, but I think it's important for us to be engaged in trying to steer it in the most positive direction for humanity.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Philip Metzger. He is a planetary scientist and the director of the Stephen Hawking Center for Microgravity Research and Education at the University of Central Florida. Philip, one thing you mentioned earlier is how this can help AI, both with resources and getting AI off planet. Ever since I've been covering the space beat, they've been talking about asteroid mining, right? I'm wondering if this kind of AI boom is what is really propelling these talks and these developments of these companies and kind of the plans to move forward at a much quicker pace than I remember to make this happen. Is AI the driving force for planetary mining?
Well, I think in the public conversation, yes, it was AI that made that big shift. However, there was a lot of work going on less publicly.
For example, Blue Origin has always had the objective of moving industry off the planet. In fact, they call their company Blue Origin, referring to the environment of our blue planet and wanting to preserve our planet. So that's always been their company's goal, to move industry onto the moon and to asteroids and save planet Earth. So it's always been going on. AI has made a sudden change in the public discussion, and it's really because Elon Musk says that he did the math. He realized that you couldn't build AI fast enough on the Earth, and you couldn't launch it fast enough from the Earth, and so therefore you've got to put a factory on the moon. He said that he wants that factory to exist in about 10 years, which is, I think, really impossibly small amount of time. I think 20 years is doable if everything goes well. Could be longer than 20, but who knows? Maybe he'll pull it off somehow in 10 years, 10 to 13.
One of the things that I've really enjoyed chatting with you about over all these years and following you on social media is you do take these kind of really deep thinks as to what our future is going to be like with space technology like this, with all sorts of space technology. And sometimes the principles that you start talking about are very science fiction, but when you talk about it to me and explain it, it's very much science fact and it's very exciting. And you make it far more realistic than I could ever imagine. So I'm going to ask you, you know, is this realistic? You mentioned Elon, he's very ambitious with his 10-year plan to get the AI into space. We're talking about mining asteroids. Are we really a decade, two decades away, or when will this happen?
For decades now already, it has not been a technological barrier. We've had the ability to do it. It's always been an economic barrier and a political barrier because there's never been a real business case. And the amount of investment up front is going to be gigantic. And there aren't a lot of stepping stones along the way. There aren't any intermediate business cases where you can make a profit unless you go big scale. That's always been the problem. What is the business case for mining in space? What I think has changed is, as we were discussing, AI. Now we've got big money companies, you know, tech giants who have a motive to develop it. And I've been trying for a long time to estimate how long it will take to build industry on the moon. It depends on the funding levels. I've been predicting 40 to 70 years before you can get a self-growing factory on the moon. Elon is now saying 10 years. What changed is the economic situation. Also, I'd like to point out that we've all got a false perspective about it because of the nature of NASA. NASA only gets a finite budget and they can only do one or two of these dramatic missions per year, even in the best of times. And those production volumes and those operational rates, you just don't get enough experience to really perfect the technology and to really make it affordable and really make it reliable. And also because these missions are small scale, the scale of your system determines the reliability. So if here on the Earth, we would have 5 billion people die if all the technology failed, because 5 billion out of 7 billion require technology to live. But what are the odds that all the technology is going to stop working on the same day? But on a NASA mission where you only have 3 redundant systems, those odds are much worse. So when you go large scale into space, these things become inherently much easier. And I think when you start to wrap your mind around that, you realize, you know, we really can do these things. They're not that impossible. It's just an economic issue.
Well, I have much more optimism for the future now after speaking with you. Philip Metzger is a planetary scientist and the director of the Stephen Hawking Center for Microgravity Research and Education at the University of Central Florida. Philip, always a pleasure to chat with you.
Oh, the pleasure was mine. Thank you.
Still to come, living in style in space.
With that further exploration eventually comes habitation. And so when we think about people habitating or living somewhere, hospitality is a natural part that goes along with it.
Space hospitality, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. From macaroni and cheese to brisket, space travelers now have a wide selection of foods to choose from. But if people want to one day live and work in space or on the moon, we're going to need a bigger menu. One chef at the University of Central Florida, along with some of his students, are trying to expand that menu and make tasty space food. We'll chat more about space cuisine on a future episode of Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about tourism. Well, space tourism, or the idea that space hotels, comfortable travels, and even restaurants are necessary for people as we move towards living off of our planet. Amy Gregory is University of Central Florida's Interim Chair of Food Service and Lodging Management and the Endowed Chair for Space Tourism Programming and Initiatives. She says space tourism isn't that far away from being a reality. Our producer, Marian Summerall, spoke with Amy about the future of traveling and living off of our planet. Here's that conversation now.
Amy, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to have you because today we're talking about something that's kind of seems crazy. It seems very futuristic. We're talking about space hospitality. Space seems pretty inhospitable as it is. You know, we think about space as this, we want to explore it, but it doesn't seem very hospitable. Let's talk about what even is space hospitality.
In our area, we pretty much put hospitality and tourism together. So maybe when you think about that, hospitality has a better link. But where we are with space right now is we know that we can do all of the propulsion and we can do the landings and we can do the exploration. And of course, naturally, with that further exploration, eventually comes habitation. And so when we think about people habitating or living somewhere, hospitality is a natural part that goes along with it. If you think about everything outside of your home or your institution, all of that is hospitality, whether it's you traveling to different destinations, be it airports, trains, whatever, cruise ships, and then also what happens when you're there, the wayfinding, you know, how do I know where to go in a new place? And so how do I get that, what Ritz-Carlton refers to as that warm welcome and the fond farewell, right? And everything that happens in between that makes it a perfect 10. I'm one of three chairs in our college. And so I'm food service and lodging management, essentially food and shelter, two of the basic needs. And so when I first started getting involved with space about 3 years ago, I thought, you know, I don't want to push too hard on this lodging and the food component because that's my department. I want to make sure that all of hospitality and tourism is brought into this whole thing. But as we got into it further, food and shelter are so essential for everything that they've really risen to the top. And they've been things that we've learned we should be focused on. And we've been invited to conversations from some organizations that have been involved in space way longer than I have. And so they're asking us, what does that hospitality look like? How do we take care of our workforce or take care of guests? I mean, now we've got private astronauts, right, that are making their way to the ISS. And that's really cool because it's the International Space Station and it's all about science and experiments and all of that. But if you see the pictures, it's not really a very pretty place. And I hear it doesn't smell so great either. And there's an awful lot of noise because of the machine. So that's fun when you're pioneering. But as we continue to advance from exploration to habitation, be it planetary or low Earth orbit, people need a place where they can relax, kind of rejuvenate themselves. They need to feel comfortable. They need to understand everything that's going to have to happen before they get there. Primarily the way that it will happen is the workforce will get there first. Companies will send people to work in space or on the moon or on Mars as they do the work that they have to do. So those individuals have to be taken care of. And so there are hospitality components within that organization, but then also to service that organization.
It's crazy to think about. We talk about planes. We talk about getting there. We talk, you know, we use cars here. To think about the hospitality behind like actually launching people from the Earth to let's use the moon for an example.
One of the analogies that I use is the cruise industry. So think about when people first started cruising. They're going on a ship, obviously, for some, maybe an uncertain environment, whether it's a claustrophobic thing in your cabin or an uncertain thing being out on the deck in the middle of the ocean, not being able to see land. So there was a whole process of getting people to understand the safety, the security, and we all go through it when we get on a cruise ship. We've got to report to our muster stations and we go through the drill about how you put on your life vest and all of that. Very necessary, of course, but also it gives an awful lot of comfort to individuals to know how they do that and what they would have to do. And so that takes away a little bit of that concern. Then you have people on a ship looking at the beautiful ocean and maybe coming up to a port, you know, from time to time and seeing a beautiful town or a city from afar and coming into that and having that feeling. So looking at the ocean, looking at all of that is fine and good. But fast forward to where we are now in the cruise ship industry that really has just grown massively, where we've got climbing walls and racetracks and, you know, all of these different experiences for people to do, because it's not just enough anymore to sit and look at the beautiful ocean. They want more. So we can go all the way back to when these space transportation companies begin to move people. And as I said, primarily, probably workers first, but transport them from one place to another. That transportation component has so many different science parts of it. You know, how much propulsion do you need to move so many people or things or objects? And then it's not as if you're going to be there in 20 minutes or an hour. In some cases, we're talking months maybe, right? So now this very efficient transportation device, for lack of a better word, rocket, whatever we want to call it, that has to be something that makes people feel comfortable, gives them a place to retreat, gives them a place to come together. Perhaps they're working in the process as well. And then think about, before you travel anywhere, go out and you find information about where you're going. That's very easy for us now, but all of that stuff had to be built up as well. That's part of the hospitality ecosystem. And then when you do know where you're going, now you get information sent to you so that it's a seamless thing. Here's what to pack before you go, or here's what you should know about the weather or whatever. So hospitality naturally thinks in that term, and how all of that comes together throughout your entire stay until you leave and hopefully come back again. So there's an awful lot of, we're starting to refer to it as the service-ology, because it all comes together in service in a variety of different forms. But we've been studying that for decades, and we know consumer behavior, and we know what makes people comfortable. We know what to do when people are not comfortable, and we teach that.
Right. It's not as easy as, like, when we say we want to have a permanent stay on the moon or on Mars. It's not as easy as just saying that. There are all these steps behind it. As we take that step, people need comfortability and a plan and packing and things like that. So I kind of see how that analogy really works.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media, I'm Brendan Byrne. You're listening to our producer, Marion Summerall, chat with Amy Gregory, University of Central Florida's Interim Chair of Food Service and Lodging Management and the Endowed Chair for Space Tourism Programming and Initiatives, about space hospitality and tourism. Here's the rest of that conversation now.
I'm really curious about the students at UCF too, the college students involved in this.
Sure. So our students last semester started participating in a student space experiment program. And so we had 12 different teams, initially about 50 students that were participating in this, where we just said to them, come up with an idea. We're all vying for, our university would have one experiment chosen to go up into space. But we let the students just kind of go crazy with it. At Rosen College, we had students that did food-based experiments. So our students looked at the formation of tofu in microgravity, because tofu is a very rich protein source. It's also a very versatile type of food. You can add flavoring to it. You can change the texture. They also looked at gelation. So how do certain foods gel in microgravity? So if you think about when you eat something, there's the physical appearance first, then you get the aroma. And then when you taste it, it's that mouth feel in addition to the tasting. So gelation allows you to make things smooth and creamy and, you know, make you feel really good.
Just like how hospitality is like a major, right? Or like our hospitality is like a branch, right? And you can take majors in within the hospitality track. We're looking at potentially in this future is kind of what you're saying, of like, this is the start to potentially, if a student goes to university and is like, I want to specifically get a degree in this. I want to work in space hospitality.
Yes.
That's really fascinating.
Yes. So what we're doing right now, unlike the College of Business, that we've launched the Space MBA program, right? Very focused degree in that area. What we're doing now is we're integrating space education into the different classes and the different degree programs that we present as well. So one very interesting thing is, and again, this is fast forwarding, but when regular people, even if they are the workers, let alone the tourists, or there will be space inhabitants too, right? We'll have those pioneers that they don't want to live on Earth anymore. They want to go live off Earth somewhere. And they'll do that without their work and without being a tourist. So those things will happen. But those people also need entertainment. So we have an entertainment management degree. So we can start studying what happens to sound and the perception of sound in microgravity. So if we're talking about music or theater, something like that, we have to take into account that entirely different environment that's there. This is the next frontier. I mean, this is kind of like the old wagon's hoe or, you know, whatever it is. It's the next place to explore. And for us, not only to live in space, but from a hospitality perspective, we talk about thriving in space. Because now we're having happen with us now is these other companies that are working on transportation are coming to us and saying, what are the factors that we need to consider in terms of making that transportation something that's comfortable for people and not scary, not just being that pioneer, but how can we make it comfortable and something that people want to do and will do so that we can then move to the next phase? So depending on when that happens, and then as I said, getting the workforce there will come well in advance of space hotels and things like that.
I'm almost thinking of it like a plane. I'm definitely looking forward to buying my weekend trip to a hotel and restaurant and service industry in space, whether it's on the moon or on Mars. And Amy, just, I really want to wrap this up with just this one last question. We talked about that, you know, this is really the start of it, right? But if you had to put, I guess, a timeline on this, are we talking about in the next few decades? Like, will I be able to maybe stay in lodging, do you think?
Absolutely, you will. In fact, I talk to my students today and I tell them certainly in their lifetime and their working lifetime, this is happening. What our students are doing right now is getting the opportunity to assist the space program and space hospitality and development at the ground level by bringing hospitality into that level. It's absolutely, you know, 10, 15 years away. I mean, again, it all depends on the getting people there. And that's the very expensive, very tough part of it.
I'm going to go ahead and build up the savings because I mean, to think about that is so cool. Amy Gregory is the UCF Interim Chair of Department of Food Service and Lodging Management, and she's the Endowed Chair for Space Tourism Programming and Initiatives at the University of Central Florida. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.